Fall 2012 CCB Conference and Convention. Welcome, everyone. And we are streaming as well, live on the internet. So if we can do a quick big hello to ACB Radio World on three, let's show them what you got. One, two, three. Ooh, that was good. This is wonderful. Okay. So, again, I want to welcome everyone to this convention. Before we officially get started with our proceedings, to those of you who have arrived on time, let's go ahead and start with a $25 door prize. And actually, it's $25, correct? $25 cash prize from CCCLV. And we're going to have Joe Xavier draw. So if he doesn't pick your name, you can come find him. Stephanie Rude, are you in the room? She is. Hey, Stephanie. And just to let everyone know, Stephanie is one of our members of the CCB streaming team. So I'd like you all to give the streaming team a wonderful, wonderful round of applause. And you know, don't let the rumor get started that, you know, the president pays you for your work on the stream, because Joe paid you. Okay. I'd like us to go ahead and get started with the session. We'd like to go ahead and start with our invocation. And I have Bishop Charlene, who is here to start us off with our invocation. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I just want to share a little story before I pray. I want to say that I am humbled and that it is a great honor to be here in your midst this afternoon. I read in a good book a story, and the story was about two blind men, and they had heard that someone was passing by that could help them see again. And so they waited, and when they knew that this person that was passing by was in the city, they found their way to the place where he was. And they began to cry out, and they cried out very loudly. And there are those that were around them that said, "Shh, shh, don't cry out. Don't bother the master." But yet they cried out even louder, because those two blind men could see far beyond their visual impairment. And I wanted to just share that little story, because the reason why we are here in this beautiful room with the Blind Community Council is because somebody was able to see far beyond their visual impairment. And I want to say that you all that are here, I have my own visual impairment, but I can see far beyond my physical disability, and so can you. Let's pray. Bow your heads. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for this opportunity to stand before the blind community. I am greatly humbled for this opportunity. And I thank you very much for these, your people that are sitting here in this room at the Marriott under the sound of my voice. Now, God, I pray in the name of Jesus that you would touch this conference and that your people will walk away with a greater vision, a bigger vision, to be able to see far beyond their physical impairment. Lord, you are able even to go in and change things. We pray that every word that is spoken and every deed that is done be an encouragement to someone. And when they leave this place, they leave this place in a better condition. Help them cry out because they can see beyond their physical disability. Help them reach out. Keep them. Send someone on the way that will not shush them up, but that will steer them in the right direction. We pray for the leaders of this blind community, of the president and her cabinet that is here. We pray for them that you would give them the wisdom and the guidance so that someone way down the line will be able to see beyond their visual impairment. And we thank you for this opportunity and thank you for your people. Amen.
Okay, I would like to have us stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. Okay. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. You may be seated. Okay. And we have some folks attempting to come in and be seated. So just want to let folks know that we started our general session a tiny bit late, but our first door prize was a cash prize. So share with your friends that we will probably be doing that at the beginning of every general session. So hopefully we'll get another lucky person to win some more of that. Okay. Next on our agenda is an update on the Department of Rehabilitation. We will have our friend Joe Xavier, Deputy Director of Specialized Services Division, for the Blind California Department of Rehabilitation. If I can go ahead and introduce Joe Xavier to you.
Okay. Cool. Thank you. So thank you, Donna, on behalf of the council, and thank you to the members of the council for inviting us to be here and to share this opportunity and to share this successful conference with you again. I also wanted to let you know that both Director Sauer and Chief Deputy Director Lee, although unable to be here, send their best wishes for yet another successful convention. And most of all, thank you to all of you as being partners with us in advancing the opportunity for employment and independence and equality for all of our Californians who are blind and visually impaired. There are a number of DOR staff here, so I'd like to just ask you to stand for a quick second. And we'd like to salute you for all the work that you do. And helping all of our consumers to get jobs, to gain their independence, and move forward with equality. Peter Dawson is up here with me. Peter is the new District Administrator for the Blind Field Services. Peter, welcome. And Peter will have an opportunity to speak to you here in a few minutes. You know, every once in a while, instead of asking for permission, it's better to beg for forgiveness. So I just ask that you keep that in mind. Is Lee Morton in the room? Okay. Is Mitch Pomerantz in the room? Could you please stand? So Lee Morton by abstention and Mr. Pomerantz as official representatives of both the Dodgers and Padres. Just a moment of silence for you. And if you are a Giants fan, hello, world champs! And if you're on ACB Radio, the world champs are in San Francisco, California! So good luck with that next year with your $400 million payroll. So on to a more serious note. I shared with Donna earlier that we still owe the council a written official response to the resolution on higher education. We spoke to you about that at the last conference, and we certainly will have that forthcoming. I was sharing with Donna that I feel a little bit like the person who's snorkeling, except that tube is supposed to be above the surface to give you air. Whew. So I'm looking forward to having some time in the coming weeks that we can send that along. So let me talk a little bit about one of the things that I think is very important when I come and speak to you and speak to all of our community forums is to provide you with an overview of what's taking place both at the state level as well as the department and within our programs, which enables you to be more informed and better partners in helping us advance all of the work that we do. And you know that these are times of constrained resources, and we continue to struggle to learn how to do more with what we have. Our former secretary, Kim Belshe, of our Health and Human Services Agency, had said that where you stood on an issue really depended on where you sat. And I think that is something that I've always remembered, and I think that will resonate with most of you. Our current secretary, Diana Duby, has said that it's no more doing more with less. These are the days where we're having to do less with less. And I think all of you certainly can feel that in the many organizations and in the many efforts that you're involved in. And yet, challenge and opportunity are the opposite sides of the same coin. Where we have a lot of challenges, we are also finding and need to continue to look for the opportunities that we will have to take advantage of to continue to move forward. So let me talk a little bit about the state's overview. The good thing is that the budget passed on time, which means that we did not have that dramatic impact on services to our consumers, particularly as they're returning to school. It mitigated, you know, the impact that is typically felt around the budget impasse. There was a budget shortfall. It closed a $16 billion gap. $8 billion of that was in cuts. $8 billion of that is predicated on revenue to be generated, hopefully next week. And there's a $1 billion reserve. There's a 5% salary reduction for state employees. So what that really translates to is that each state employee is working one day less per week, per month. So if we have 100 staff in Blind Field Services, that's 100 days a month less that they're available to provide services to our consumers. And without the anticipated revenue generation, we can anticipate another $6 billion cut. And we are not under any circumstances looking forward to that. The department's budget is $421 million. We have 1,823 positions. There's $55.8 million that is general fund, which represents about 13% of our total budget. This budget cycle, one of the things that was done was that the budget was trued. And essentially what that means is that we had the opportunity to align our expenses with the realities that we worked in. So, for example, our operating expenses, you know, were lease costs continue to rise. We had an opportunity to align the budget to cover those costs, as well as one of the major things that took place is you recall that there was this 5% salary savings, which meant that we needed to keep the equivalent of 5% of salaries vacant in order to meet that requirement. So there's no longer that requirement in place, which means now we get to fill the positions, but of course there's, you know, more to the filling positions than just having that out of the way. And the other thing that is important to recognize is it did not result in a loss of funds, because the vacancy, the 5% reduction, was one that was already in place. We just no longer have those positions. We still do have some dollars that we did. So let's talk about some DOR staffing update. And first of all, I'd like to thank Donna and the council for your participation on a number of our interview panels for key positions, which of course has included Peter's position, and several others. So thank you very much to you for your contribution, your participation. Here are the hires that have been made within this last year. Junie Lee, our Chief Deputy Director. Pat Santillanes, our Deputy Director of our Policy and Resources Division. Jeff Rio, over our Collaborative Services Branch. Mark Ehrlichman, over our Programs and Supports Branch. Will Scholes, Greater Los Angeles District Administrator. Rosa Gomez, the OCB Administrator. Peter Dawson, Blindfield Services District Administrator. Carol Ash, District Administrator for the Greater East Bay. Robert Lowen, the District Administrator for the San Diego District. Jay Onash, District Administrator for the Northern Sierra District. Connie DeMant, our Legislative Deputy. Suzanne Chan, Operations and Accountability Officer. Elena Gomez, Specialized Services Assistant Deputy Director position. Brian Connors has been appointed to the liaison to our advisory bodies. And we have one major vacancy at the moment at this level, which is the Executive Director for the California Committee on Employment of Persons with Disabilities. That is a whole lot of leadership shift in 1 year. We're very grateful because we have people standing by in the wings, in the bench, to take those positions, such as Rosa and Peter and the others that have stepped up. So let me talk real briefly about some of the major initiatives that the department has underway. Our VR service delivery, we've spoken to you about that. That continues. We're looking to continue to move that along. And by the way, there's a reports available on DOR's webpage for any of those who are interested to go and read these reports. The Rehabilitation Resources Database, that has also been made live and is available on our webpage. The hearing officer, our Rehabilitation Appeals Board, has moved to a hearing officer, which was effective at the end of July. DOR strategic plan, it continues. There are also some reports up on the webpage, and I'll talk more specifically about the program strategic planning. State price schedule. We have had a significant initiative underway that the council has participated in, as well as the Blind Advisory Committee and many other stakeholders. And we are knocking on wood, hoping that we'll see that come into full effect in January of 2013. I think that one of the key things that I want to talk about with the state price schedule, I mentioned this before, but I think one key point that I would make here is that we're really looking to do a paradigm shift in changing the procurement of AT goods and services from a cost-first principle to a need and effectiveness-first principle. Of course, cost will always be there. We are the state of California. But if we can just shift that paradigm thinking, and it's not been easy for those of you who have been involved, you'll know that, but I think it would be very valuable to us. We have instituted statewide contracts to provide interpretive services, which means that individuals who are deaf and hard of hearing, whether they work for departments or are in situations where they need that, the departments need to provide the services, that those are now available in a more readily fashion. Consumer services and payment processing, we have began at the request of the BAC some time ago. We've taken that effort up in the last few months to look at that whole invoice processing system We've got to find a way to do that in a much more effective and efficient manner. The VR vendor utilization. We have begun a project to look at our rehabilitation services that we provide and the manner that we're providing those, and to see which ones are effective and efficient, which ones that we need to revisit, which ones are not there that we need to be adding. We started out with a listening session of our stakeholders that took place the end of August. The other project that's underway is a coordination of the program reviews slash audits. As you know, when you get federal funds, there's a requirement to do a lot of programmatic oversight and auditing. And so what we're looking to do is to streamline that process so an agency that has three or four funding streams isn't repeatedly asked for the same information. This will allow us to improve our overall understanding of the entity, as well as improve the effectiveness and efficiency of technical assistance to the agencies. Let me scroll through some of this. Cold case project. We are also have undertaking a cold case project, and in effect, what it is, you know, we spend considerable dollars providing services to consumers. And from time to time, we lose contact with those consumers. So what the cold case project does is it has a team of individuals that is reaching out to those consumers that we've lost contact with to, one, reestablish contact and see if they need services to finish off their employment goals. And where they become employed, it allows us to take advantage of that and get our due credits, as well as any reimbursements that may be due to the department. And then also increase employment outcomes. 30% of individuals with disabilities are working, which means 70% are not. Now, OMB reports that 200,000 individuals with disabilities have now joined the federal workforce, and that's a significant uptick, so we're very appreciative for all of the policies and practices that have gone into play to support that. DOR hires are 25% of persons with disabilities. DOR promotions are individuals with disabilities. 70% of the consumers the DOR serves are Category 1 individuals with most significant disabilities. Why do I mention that to you? Because all of the initiatives that I've just now listed to you are all aimed at bending the curve on employment, improving that employment, improving independence, and moving people towards that equality. DOR is going to celebrate its 50th anniversary in 2013. We encourage the council and all of our communities to become part of that celebration. The Blind Advisory Committee, I'm very hopeful, will take a role in that as well, so the council is well represented on that, as well as any individual efforts that we can collaborate on. So a couple of miscellaneous topics. The travel restrictions that are in effect for discretionary travel continue, i.e. you have Peter here today because he happens to live in San Diego and not Rosa. So hopefully we'll have Rosa at the next convention. And, you know, you guys have had in the past where we've had a lot of staff where we've been able to bring them to the conferences. That may return one day in the future, but it is not available to us today. Also, I encourage you, businesses, and anybody that's interested to visit our Department of Personnel Administration's webpage, where there are a number of resources that have been developed and available on the training of sensitivity, awareness, and the hire of persons with disabilities. And one key point there is that the state has now instituted that as part of the mandatory training for supervisors, part of their 80-hour course, disability awareness will be part of that. And that's it's not the total answer, but it is a step to continue to improve the hire of persons with disabilities. So, shameless plug for the state, for the department to hire more persons who are blind and visually impaired, they need to take the tests. They need to do well on those exams, and they need to be ready for those opportunities when they come about. We have staff support services analysts. These are all online exams you can take from the comfort of your home in your pajamas. So, So support services, I'm not going to repeat what Donna said. Support services assistant, staff services analyst, associate government program analysts, qualified rehab professionals or counselors, staff services managers 1 and 2. Please encourage people to learn about and take these exams. And Don, if you remind me, I'll send you some information about how to get to those links and some information that could be relevant you can share with the community. All right, so let me talk briefly about OCB, and then I'll turn it over to Peter to talk about Blind Field Services. So we know that I've shared with you, and you guys by now have heard that Rosa Gomez was appointed OCB administrator effective in July. The renovation has finally concluded. Contractors, DGS, hammers, dust, noise is gone. And we have a very, very beautiful campus. If you are in the neighborhood, I encourage you to stop by, take a tour, take a visit, take a look at what's been accomplished there. We're revamping the curriculum. There's an awful lot of work to be done on that. As part of the renovation, there was a computer lab that was installed, which provides the students with the opportunity for increased PC and AT device learning. We've established apartments that allow for the students to simulate living independently on their own and yet have the benefit of the teachers around to provide any touch-up guidance and to address any issues that could arise. And Rosa has established an internship opportunity for the students. It means that they're actually going to work in groundskeeping, food services, admin, so that they can begin to prepare themselves for the expectations and the benefits of work. Conducting strategic planning. That's been major. It's undergoing with all of our programs. And that starts with a vision. All blind and visually impaired Californians that want to go to work are working. And those who do not think they can go to work are getting the counseling to overcome their barriers. We need to ask ourselves 3 key questions, and we have had these forums in the community. What are we not doing today that we need to do more of to get to that point? What are we doing that does not contribute to that that we need to let go of? And that is a very, very difficult question to answer. And the reality is, if you're going to take on new things, and we're already way overstretched, we've got to identify what to let go of so that we can continue. And we also have to identify what is it that we are doing, because we are doing good things, and we need to honor those and do more of them and better. Stakeholder input has been key. We have not yet concluded with all of our stakeholder input, and we are committed to doing so. So hopefully in the next few weeks, that'll wrap up. And at OCB, we have been recruiting for the OCB Assistant Administrator. That was a change that we made with Rose's appointment. Instead of having a rehab supervisor, we will now have an OCB Assistant Administrator, which we believe is key to providing the leadership and supporting Rosa and what she's doing there and moving the whole program forward. Key hires that have been made there, we've hired a counselor. Finally, after about 6 months of effort, we hired a stationary engineer because we had hired one a year ago who took another job and left. So we were able to go back out, recruit, and identify a qualified individual who has also begun their duties. And Rosa has been very, very busy aligning her staffing resources. Because really, in order for us to make effective and sustainable program improvements, we need to make sure that we have the right staffing doing the right things. So let me stop there and turn this over to Peter so I can catch my breath, and Peter can provide you some updates on Blind Field Services, and then I'll come back to you with a couple more.
Good afternoon, everybody. Joe's always hard to follow. He doesn't have any sense of humor or charm or charisma. And so I always think to myself, I better go first next time. But anyway, I just wanted to stress to Joe and to CCB representation who was on the interview panel to hire me, thank you and for supporting the hire of me to come back to Blind Field Services. It's great to be back. for those of you who don't know, I was on the other side, on the generalist side, as the acting district administrator for San Diego most recently. Before that, supervisor with the generalist. And then prior to that, maybe 5-6 years ago, I was with Blind Field Services. I started there about, I don't know, 13 years ago in Anaheim as a counselor for blind there, and then came down to San Diego after I got married, and I've been here ever since, and now I'm in the current position. And the only connection I have, this is my first CCB convention, so be nice to me. Thank you very much. In my prior life as an attorney up in Seattle, I have to say, though, I was part of the American Blind Lawyers Association, so I get a little credit, right? So, yeah, so I was connected to ACB through that for years, and so I know some people through that. Joe stole some of my thunder with some of those numbers and things you heard. One number that did stick out to me, was kind of interesting, is that the Dodgers payroll salary that he mentioned was very similar to the entire Department of Rehab's budget for the year, which is kind of pathetic. But we'll do better to try to get some of that money back. And another number Joe didn't mention, which is really kind of stuck out to me, and something I heard Joe mention recently, I think it was in a BAC meeting, was we're down, I think, 400 positions from our peak about 9 years ago. That's department-wide, so that's a pretty dramatic drop when we only have 1,850 or so people right now. And so keep that in mind, too. We're doing the best we can, but we can still do good work. It's just, like Joe said, we got to kind of try and do more with less. So, but we're doing our best, and hopefully with some elections coming up and things, some things will start to turn around. Keep your fingers crossed on that. So I think you know what I'm talking about. So what else? I just sort of introduced who I was. Like I said, I'm from Seattle. If those of you who want to talk to me, you know how to get a hold of me. I have kind of open door policy, although it's been kind of crazy catching up, and there's a learning curve that I've been exposed to, but I'm, you know, it's been really enjoyable coming back and getting back into the issues and what has to happen. The number Joe mentioned, 70% unemployment, you know, that number just hasn't changed for years and years and years. And I know there's a lot of people who are concerned that the, you know, federal Congress at some point might decide, you know, why do we keep doing this if it's not getting any better? So that's a little scary to think about. And so we need to do something better, make some changes. And like Joe gave you his list, you know, what are we not doing that we need to do? I have some of my own ideas. I won't share them all with you today. But even though the blind do have a higher wage, you know, the cases that get closed competitively, I think Joe was telling me that that's about $19 an hour, as opposed to the rest of the Department of Rehab consumers, which is about $12 an hour. So that is a positive. The target Joe set was 800 competitive placements at $800 a week. That's a tall order. I think he upped it this year to 1,000 a week. Is that right, Joe?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So, which is obviously work to try to get people good jobs, not just any jobs. One thing I've noticed, I see a lot of, you know, people either on the one end, like in customer service jobs, and or maybe at the other end, rehab counselors, and not much in the middle. And that goes not just for here, that goes just my observation of the country as a whole. There's the middle class seems to be evaporating. I'd love to make some, you know, see what we could do to try to get some people some good jobs who may not want to go get a master's degree or that kind of thing. So I'm interested in exploring options, whether they're certificate programs and things that you see for people who are sighted out there, you know, whether all these radiology tech and medical things and stuff that are out there. I mean, what are our options? So I got a lot of work to do, and I'm excited and interested in doing this. And Joe mentioned the strategic planning a little bit. They've been doing a lot of work, and it's been interesting to listen in on some of those sessions. Some of you might have been some of those. Good input. I've been impressed with Tom Dempsey, who's been coordinating a lot of those and listening to the input, which we hope to incorporate in making some of these changes. And thank you for your participation in those. And we look forward to sort of a 5-year plan ahead based on that, not just for the department as a whole, but for BFS in particular. So with that, I'll just say once again, thank you for having me here. I'll be around for a little while to try to hopefully say hello to some of you I haven't seen in a long time. And anything else, Joe, in particular you wanted me to address that I missed? Yeah, okay. Well, thank you very much, and we'll look forward to seeing you in the future.
So Donna just told me I had 4 minutes left, so I'm going to continue along here. So real briefly, because I want to provide opportunity for some Q&A.
Don't pull the wire. I will not.
Is everybody still here? What happened?
I pulled the wire on the mic.
She pulled the wire. Don't pull the wire on the mic. That hurts.
No.
Okay. OIB programs. I'm just real quickly a couple updates, and then we'll do quick questions. OIB updates. Major things that have taken place there are that the establishing catchment areas and then establishing the methodology to distribute the money to that, establishing the methodology to distribute money within the catchment areas, as well as looking at measurements of quality and quantity for services within OIB, very closely involved with the Blind Advisory Committee on that and the rest of the community. And then on the Business Enterprises Program, by the way, strategic planning is taking place there as well. On the Business Enterprises Program, the vendors had their annual educational forum at the beginning of September, and the strategic planning in that program continues there as well. One note that might be of interest to you there. There are 26 staff supporting BEP. 16 of them are not in the same position they were in 2008. 7 were hired this calendar year alone. That's a significant shift in the workforce in that program, as well as, it, as I pointed out earlier, in the leadership of the California Council, leadership of the department. Let me just share a couple of quick thoughts here before we open this up for questions. Scrolling. Okay, hold on. Okay. So I'm going to share this with you, and particularly in light of what Peter has shared and some of the stuff I talked about earlier. To avoid being criticized, do nothing, say nothing, and be nothing. And continuing to do the same will only ensure that we continue to get the same outcome. Welcoming change does not mean that we can continue to do the same thing. And those sound so nice, but that's the reality. If we're going to make the changes that we need to make, those are some basic realities that we need to deal with as an organization, as a community, as partners. So with that, let me conclude my comments here. And Donna, I'm assuming you'd like Q&A time? Mike?
Madam President.
Oh, the loud one. Notice I said that with love, though, and before we go on, I just want to say that, and I said it last night at the board meeting, I am very thankful that this year he is here with all of us instead of where he was last year. And so I'll give it over to the loud one. Go ahead, Mitch.
Thanks. All I can say is only the good die young. Two quick questions, Joel. One of them I asked you before, and I'm going to keep asking it to you. The first question has to do with the pilot program at LAX with the vendor and how that's working out and whether, in fact, that may lead to future initiatives with my former employer, the City of Los Angeles. And my second question has to do with a program that may or may not still exist, the LEAP program with the state of California, which I think stood for Limited Examination Assistance or Appointment Program, something on that order. Does that program still exist?
So to your first question, you remember what my answer was last time?
I do, and I was hoping for a different one.
No. So I do not, the LA program, in as far as I know, is working very well. It's not on my radar these days. That's a good thing. And in as far as expanding that into county and city, obviously we need to continue to look for opportunities. Have we done anything along those lines? No. These days we're dealing more with electrical services and meters and a few other things of that nature. And as far as limited examination appointment program, yes, it continues. Yes, we continue to promote it. And yes, it is an avenue, if you are an individual with a disability, to be hired by the state of California. In effect, you have a two-month probation period where the supervisor and you get to determine if that's a good fit, if you bring the required skills and talents to the position, at which time you move into a regular hire and go through the six-month probation. So I encourage you, good point, Mitch, to take advantage of that as well. And just a side note, I would have thought that after your activities over the last year, you would move over to the Giants as a rooting team.
While I don't have the same enmity towards San Francisco that a lot of Angelenos do, my dislike for the Giants goes back for as long as I've been rooting for the Dodgers, and that's 54 years. Sorry.
Time to change.
Okay. Next question, Pedro.
Hi. Thank you. I'm curious. I've been hearing the figure 70% unemployment for blind folks for so many years. I'm just curious to know, how often do they review those? Do those take into account self-employed blind? And are those only people who have gotten their jobs through rehab? Just curious. Thank you.
It's data that is provided generally through the census and through the Bureau of Labor Statistics with the Department of Labor. Yes, Judy. Donna said yes, Judy. I'm saying yes, Judy.
Joe, could you go a little bit over again? You talked about the word paradigm shift in regard to procuring assistive technology. It kind of went by fast. Could you just kind of review that a little bit in detail for me, please?
Sure. So this started several years ago, where the Department of General Services is the control agency that has the oversight over the procurement methodology. And the state price schedule is one of the vehicles used to procure, goods and services. And in effect, as it is much of the case with all matters procurement, it's generally driven by cost first. So if you're selling something to me for $10 and Mitch is selling it for $9, I got to buy it from Mitch, even if Mitch's product may not quite be up to the snuff of yours, generally speaking. I couldn't resist, Mitch. So what has been undertaken over the last couple of years is to shift, first of all, to preserve that as a vehicle, because there's motivations for that. One is we want the state to hire more persons with disabilities, and therefore we need to make accommodations effective and efficient in a much more timely manner. Two, we want our consumers to be able to go to work much faster, so the same thing applies there. And if California is going to be a model employer, we need to lead the way, not just talk about it. So that whole shift, at the same time, needs to be providing the services through vendors who are qualified and responsive and responsible and are knowledgeable about matters AT, both goods and services. And so the shift comes from driving the AT product and good by what's the most effective and efficient product slash service first, and then build in the cost next, as opposed to the other way around.
And on a brief note, I did want to remind folks that CCB did write a resolution related to the state price schedule. And this body adopted it at one of our past conventions. So we're very pleased. you know, still things that are being worked on, but we're very pleased with the regular updates that we get with the happenings of that program. Are there any other questions? Okay. Ed's going back.
Joe, there's a screen reader out called System Access, and wanted to know if it's possible that rehab would in the future start buying System Access for students for college.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure that I understood. Could you repeat that again?
Okay. My question was the screen reader, System Access, made by Serotech. I wanted to know if in the future rehab would possibly buy the screen reader for students, college students.
So let me speak to that real briefly, and then I'll turn it over to Peter that maybe I can provide more detail. When we determine the EAT that is appropriate for a consumer, that's the consumer working with the counselor, and when and as needed, a qualified individual to do the assessment of what's the best product to meet that individual's needs. So let me turn this over to Peter.
Yeah, I would agree exactly with what Joe just said. If that's something that you've determined works best for you, I haven't heard of that. But like I said, I've got a lot of things I'm catching up on over the last few years. Then that's fine. If you want to call me and talk about it further, I'll leave my telephone number here, and you can call me. I'm assuming you're in school now, correct?
Yeah, I was in school.
You were in school. Okay. So if the question is whether we would provide that, if that's what works best for you and was necessary to get you through your individual plan for employment, I would think that was fine if that's what the assistive technology evaluation determined. So if that didn't happen and there's a problem there or an issue, let me know about it, and we'll try to get that resolved. Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay.
We have one more question. Okay.
Donna, thank you. Council, thank you very much. It's been a great honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much, Joe. I would like us to go ahead and draw a door prize before we introduce our next speaker. So, do you have a door prize? Okay, we have a T-shirt from Yosemite Gateway, and we have my favorite fudge from Alameda. And if we can have Judge Sumowski draw the winning door prize ticket. Daryl Dawes, you are the winner. And you just asked the question. Congratulations. Bravo. Okay. Our next speaker is, the title of his presentation is Success Through Education, Technology, and Perseverance. Judge David M. Sumowski from San Diego, California. Judge Sumowski is assigned to the San Diego Criminal Court. Areas to be covered in his presentation are law school challenges, employment experiences, motivation, networking, ambition, law practice obstacles, and adaptations, judging pro and con, and finding happiness and success in life. Please join me in welcoming Judge Sumowski to our convention.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Can you all hear me? Yes. All right, good. Is that what I was supposed to talk about? I was making some further notes at home this morning, and rearranged things a little bit, but I think we're going to touch on all of that. Thanks for welcoming me to your statewide convention, I think it is, correct? All right, it's the first time I've been here, and welcome to San Diego if you're not from here. We have a nice day for you for a change. It's been a little warm. I got into the situation that brings me to an organization like this, having been in the military after my college days, and I was injured in Vietnam, which is where I lost my eyesight. So I come at blindness from a little bit of a different perspective maybe than some of you. When I went through my rehab process through the VA system at Hines, Illinois, I was quite a bit younger. It was 1969. I was 23 years old. And when I finished that, I was wondering what I was going to do with the rest of my life, and decided that I thought I would try to go to law school. So I applied to some law schools. I got into one, and my law career sort of started then at the University of Denver. And it was a big experiment back in 1970 because 5 blind students were admitted. And I don't think they had a blind person in that law school for maybe 20 years before that time. So it was kind of interesting for us as 5 blind people, and interesting for the school because they weren't quite sure what they were doing or how it was going to work. But I did get through law school in the time that most people do. It's about 3 years. I went to summer school, so I actually finished a semester or a quarter early. And I went through school at that time with readers who usually were other law students, figuring if they were really going to do the work and read it, they might as well read it to me, and I'd pay them a couple bucks an hour. That was a lot of money back then. And I used tape recorders in my classes. I recorded the lectures. I didn't know Braille real well. I knew the symbols, obviously, but speed was another factor. Being newly blinded, I'm not real proficient at it. Even 40 years later, I use it, but I certainly don't use it to the extent that others might. But then at night I would take the tapes home. I would listen to them again. So I figured I went to law school twice. And figured the government got their money's worth having sent me to law school. And I synthesized all the tapes at night, and maybe an hour's lecture became 10 minutes of stuff that I thought was important to try to remember when exam time came. So anyway, I got through law school, and I took the bar exam in Colorado, passed it, then had some difficulty landing on my feet in the legal field, and I'll come back and talk about job searching and things like that in a minute. But after a while, things weren't working for me in Colorado, so I decided, where would I like to live? I was footloose and fancy free, single. I thought, let's go to Hawaii. Oops, dog quarantine. And I had a dog, and I still have a dog, number 5 today. So I said, all right, mentally I traced back, where would I like to live? And so I came to San Diego, because that was the first stop on the mainland as you're coming back from Hawaii. And I didn't know anybody, but I moved out here in 1976 and got involved in a local congressional campaign for something to do, because I wasn't quite sure where I was going to end up. And finally, in 1977, I really got my first job, and that was with the Veterans Administration as a counselor for veterans. I did that for about 3 years, and then I decided, gee, I went to law school, I passed a bar in one state, I ought to really give it a shot. And so I left the VA, I took the bar exam here, and after I passed it, an opportunity through the federal government's action committee, which I don't think is in existence now, had veterans leadership groups starting around the country to help change the image of Vietnam veterans, which was kind of negative at the time. And I started the San Diego office, and I did that for about a year and a half before I really decided I needed to try and go to work as a lawyer. I applied for jobs. I actually got some interviews, which I thought was a plus, some corporate interviews, some firm interviews. And ultimately, I just missed the hiring process in the district attorney's office. So I had some friends who had a law firm practice, and they offered to let me office with them and see what business I could get. So I made the critical mistake early on of thinking appearance meant a lot. So I spent a lot of money on furniture. And I paid my share of the rent. And I borrowed $50,000 from the Small Business Administration. And a year later, I was broke. So that was a lesson that was a good lesson, actually. But I realized that getting people to come in the door and see you was going to be a challenge. I went to bar meetings. I went to seminars. I went to subject to topical area seminars to meet other lawyers, pass out business cards, which were probably a little too glossy. That's probably where some of the 50 grand went. And I got a little bit of business. I did a little bit of corporate work. I did some wills and some trusts, and I did a couple of little criminal things, misdemeanor things. But I ran out of money, and I just couldn't stay officing with these guys because I wasn't able to pay my bill. But about that time, I did go back to the district attorney's office for an interview, and the timing was good. And one thing led to another, and I was hired, and in 1986, I went to work as a deputy district attorney and went through all the things new lawyers do. I did misdemeanors, I did issuing of cases, and then I got transferred to a branch office where I started doing trials with misdemeanors. And 4 years later, I came back downtown to do felony trials. And ultimately, at the time I was appointed to be a judge in 1998, I was doing the disposition conferences for felony cases, which was kind of a critical role in most all district attorney's offices, because if you don't settle the cases, the courts are going to be jammed. And as you may know, 90-95% of the cases settle before trial. I worked in the law office with my friends by paying a reader to come in and help me with what was needed. In the district attorney's office, I was fortunate enough to have an enlightened DA who saw the value of my having a paralegal, and he paid for it. So that was good. So I hired a lady that worked with me for most of my DA career until she got ill and had to leave. But they gave me somebody else to work with for the balance of the time I was there. And she was able to do research for me. And at the time, I had the old Kurzweil scanner that stood about 3 feet high. And I started with the Keynote. Some of you may have remembered that. That's what I started with. But mostly, it was reading and taking some notes in Braille with the old Perkins Brailler, which I still have. And doing trials. I loved being a trial lawyer because it meant when the game started, I get to stand up, I get to talk, and I get to do the job, fall flat on my face if I'm going to, but there's nobody there who's going to take the credit or suffer the ignominy if it doesn't work out. And it, obviously, being a prosecutor to me was very important. I try to do the right thing for my client, which is you, the people of California, and keep our community safe. And it was interesting, and it was great having Pat work with me as a paralegal. I always thought, though, as I was getting a little older, that maybe a nice way to finish my career would be to try to be a judge. There's a couple ways you can do that. You can run for an open seat in an election. Judge seats at the Superior Court level are 6-year terms, and so every 6 years, if you want to take on a sitting judge, you can. That's not usually the smartest thing to do. In LA, I am told it's blood sport to go after sitting judges, but fortunately in San Diego, very, very rarely does someone take on a sitting judge. So there's value in being an incumbent. And I've been there going on 15 years now. I just have one more term to, election, I should say, to get through until I reach my retirement age. And I'm not overly concerned, frankly. That's one way you can do it. I happen to do it through the appointment process. I kept telling my buddies that I was going to file for a judge. It's a 45-question application, and you know, every week I would answer a question. And they kept wondering, well, when are you going to do it? I said, well, you know, it's 45 questions. It's 45 weeks. You know, this week it's my name. And then you get down to the nitty-gritty where you talk about 5 or 6 trials that you've done, what the result was, why you thought they were important trials, why you want to be a judge, things of that nature. And those are the tougher questions to answer. But I filled out the application. I had it ready to go. I came to a deputy DA's statewide convention where Pete Wilson was going to be speaking. I was accompanied by the then-elected district attorney who, after the governor's talk, came up and introduced me. And I shook hands with Governor Wilson and said, it's nice to meet you. And I'm standing there with a dog. I figured, you know, this is an impression that'll sit with him for a minute. And I said, I'm going to be applying for a judge. And he said, oh, that's nice. Well, blah, blah. And the next thing I did is drop my application in the mail the next day. So I figure with my picture stamped on the application, although he probably wouldn't see it, if ever, at least the impression would be made when the judicial secretary gets the application, hey, you've got a blind person applying to be a judge. And, you know, maybe the light clicked with him. Well, I just met a guy like that. That was in June, and then the following February, I was appointed in 1998. And I had a 4-year run before I had to worry about an election, because then municipal court judges were in vogue. The consolidation didn't happen until later that year. So I got to serve out the 4-year balance of a term of a judge who had died in office. And then I have been running every six years since then. So that's how the law business went for me to where I am today. What is it like to be a judge? Well, having been a prosecutor, you know, the hat tipped one way. When you become a judge, the hat isn't supposed to tip. And I knew that, and I think I bend over backwards to make sure that I am fair in all of my rulings. Obviously, doing criminal work, the district attorney's office that I work for is in front of me every day, and I know most of the DAs. A lot of them have retired, and a lot of younger ones are coming in, so I don't know all of them, but I try to listen, which is, I think, one of the key ingredients, and fortunately my hearing is good. I try to exercise patience, and at times That's a little difficult with lawyers who, A, don't come to court on time, B, think they get paid by the word, and C, who have made their point in the first minute, and the next 9 minutes, I'm sort of thinking about what I'm going to have for dinner. But I look interested. And finally, since I do a high-volume criminal calendar, I just have to cut them off. And I give them my ruling, and they all say thank you. and they say, Your Honor. Isn't that nice? And then I go on to other cases. But it's been fun at times. It's frustrating and depressing at times because I see some really nasty things coming through my court. I do arraignments in the afternoon, so if it's newsworthy, I'm the guy that's going to have the cameras in court. The molest cases are heart-wrenching. There's a lot of domestic violence that goes on. There's a lot of alcohol and drug abuse that comes in the form of criminal activity, whether it's the drug itself or it's leading to violence and robberies and things of that nature. So I try to keep a poker face and not let my personal views get in the way. I try to set bail fairly at what I think is appropriate for what's before me, taking into account public safety issues and prior criminal records and things of that nature. I have an assistant that sits up on the bench with me in the afternoons because there's no time for advanced prep on arraignments. The DA is bringing the case in and the paperwork is being created for it as it comes in and they're brought to my desk, and Soshi, who works with me now, is whispering things to me as the public defender is doing the arraigning, or the defense attorney, as the case may be. And she's telling me what the charges are, what the bail is, what the record is, what the score is for risk assessment, prior records, are they on probation, are they on parole, are they now under post-release supervision under new 8109 stuff. And she's throwing a lot of stuff at me, and I don't have to say much. I just enter not guilty pleas. Nobody pleads guilty at arraignment. Most of the time they don't have their lawyer with them. It's just a counseling attorney. And then I'll ask the DA to tell me a little bit about the facts. And I usually can tell, having been a DA, I know what all the crime charges are, and I can almost tell you what happened in this whole scenario just by looking at the way it's charged, you know, whether it's a stolen car and then a high-speed chase and all of a sudden the fight with the cops. You know, there's three different charges. You can pretty much tell what happened. I set bail. I asked them if they want a bail review, which is reconsideration in 3 days if they want it. I'm generally adjusting bail at arraignment based on the charges that I see, and most people don't want to come back and see me again in 3 days, which is fine. So then they go on and the case moves along in the system. I mentioned that I'm kind of the media point of contact. Most judges will not let the media in their courtroom. They just think it's distracting, which it is. Gives attorneys a chance to showboat a little bit, and it takes away from the dignity of the courtroom in many ways, and it tends to give different influences on different aspects of the case, which probably should not be fairly given. But I let the media in because I'm the point of contact of the community, and while in some cases I may not like that, that's kind of the marching orders I have from my presiding judge. We need good relations with the media. So I let them film the arraignments. I will make them tell the face of the defendants if I think there are issues for personal safety of the defendant while in jail on certain kinds of cases, such as child molest, or if there's snitch issues where if the other inmate's in jail, and they do watch TV in jail, if they think, you know, they got a bad dude in their midst, that might not be healthy for that person. Or there may be some other reasons to towel the face, in which case you get the scrambled version of it on the news at night. And that's when I get a lot of publicity, because they don't want to put up just a scrambled towel face, so they show me. And And, you know, so I have to get a haircut about once a month. But it's okay, because now everybody in the little town where I live thinks that I do all these wonderful high-profile cases and I have just such a great job and I'm doing a great job for the community. And little do they know that I touched it on day one and I didn't really do the trial. And when the case does go to trial, the only film that the media has is me. And so when the case is going to a trial or going to a verdict and the judge that did the trial is doing the sentencing, the media is doing the case now, but whose face are they showing? Mine. So I get a lot of credit that I probably don't deserve there. In looking for work, I wanted to touch on this. I think, obviously, I heard that figure thrown out earlier, 70% unemployment for the blind, I guess you were referring to. There's some challenges that way. I suppose there's two schools of thought on when applying for a job, should you tell somebody about your disability or not. When I applied, part of my resume included my stint in the military, the fact that I was very involved with the Blind Veterans Association. So, you know, it was sort of right out there on the resume. I've rethought that a little bit, especially in light of the changes in the technology lately. Now, I don't really need a reader except for what I do in the afternoon. Sometimes I use a reader just to prepare my notes for the next morning's probation cases that I review, but all of that stuff is online now. The probation department has all of their reports online and they can email them to me. Everything involving legal research now through LexisNexis and Westlaw is all online. Computers were obviously not around when I went to law school. I have a Dell computer. I'm not pushing Dell, I just happen to like it. And that's what the office has too. So I matched my home computer to the office computer. I use JAWS. I've used JAWS from the get-go. I know Window Eyes is out there, and there may be others, but I've gotten very comfortable with JAWS. I now have OpenBook, and I have the scanner camera, the Pearl, which makes anything given to me at the last minute, which is often, lawyers never file timely, it gives me an ability to just go in and throw it under the scanner, and if you've used the Pearl, you know that within 4 seconds or so, whatever you just clicked is coming up on your computer in the OpenBook program, and I can read it. Doesn't do anything with handwritten stuff, which a lot of defendants who do their own legal work, they write out in very poor handwriting. It's very hard for even my sighted help to read. But I think what you need to do is, if you have skills, use them. If you don't, get them. Get all the education that you think you can afford or can have available to you. Use the technology and get familiar with how to use it if you aren't familiar with it, because it is a technological world now. And most anything you are going to do, you're going to have to be, I think, computer literate. I would say to try and get as much experience as you can. Sometimes you're going to have to think small first. And that may mean getting involved in volunteer groups where you can do something to demonstrate not only to yourself but to others that you have the ability to be productive at something. Use that to network with the people you meet, whether it's through organizations such as this or through community groups or church groups, other nonprofits, to try and parlay some of that knowledge, skill, and experience that you're getting and the technical skills that you have into doing something a little more interesting and more productive. Getting back to the, do you tell the employer about the disability or not. I think not, because I think if you throw that out on a resume, you have given them a reason to not even give you an interview, especially in this day and age when competition for work is so keen and everybody is looking for a job. You are competing against other people. I think you need to get in the door, and when you get there, you dazzle them with your brilliance. If you have an ability to speak well, and I think you need to work on that, don't say like, don't say you know, things like that. Get in the door. It's going to be very difficult for you to walk for a business to have you walk in, and then all of a sudden the interview isn't going to happen because all of a sudden you're standing there with a cane or a dog. I think once you can get in the interview, you can disarm them by talking about why you're there and figuratively look them in the eye and tell them, I'm the guy or the lady for this job and why, and tell them what you've done, what you can do, how well you know what their business is, how you plan to use your knowledge and experience and your technological skills, if it's called for, to do the job. And try to leave them with the impression that, okay, you're not a blind person, you are a person who has a disability, but you can probably do this job, or at least we will give you a chance. So that would be the approach I would take if I was doing it today. I'm kind of glad I don't have to do it today. I'm looking forward to retiring myself. But so that's the way I would leave you with that. I think also it's important for you to try to stay positive with your attitude. Be patient. I know that's a little tough at times for people, especially if you've been looking for a long time. But if you don't have a positive attitude, it's going to show right away. And people will pick up on that. And they say, oh, this person's a downer. This isn't going to help the atmosphere in this business. I would try to keep a good support system, stay healthy, stay focused. If you have good family relationships, make sure you maintain those. Your friendships are important. Try not to have too much stress in your life. Balance is important. Have some decent hobbies where you can, forget about the problems that you have, but try and do some fun things. I'm a golfer. Not ready to go on tour yet, but I try to play as much golf as I can, and I'm fairly good at it for someone who can't see. And I think my buddies are ready to take a few strokes away from me on my handicap. I have my dog here, Kenny. He's number 5 for me. And my wife, Janice, is up here with me as well. And I read a lot. I like to walk. You've got to find an outlet to offset the things that weigh heavily on you. And those are some of the ways that I do it. I wanted to leave some time for questions because I didn't speak specifically yet to how I actually handle evidence and things. But if you're interested in that, I'd be happy to talk about it. What I do now doesn't involve a lot of evidence. It's more listening, and that's kind of key. Most of my stuff is with defendants, and that you ask me how do I know they're lying? I said I just assume they're lying. And then I look for something that maybe tells me I'm wrong, and occasionally that happens. But in the probation arena, I'm not dealing with the really bad people. Those people hopefully are in prison. I'm dealing with people who have made bad choices, and that just means they need to have their behavior modified a little bit. And for a period of time, I get to be the modifier. And I try to do that in a fair way. I give them enough rope to hang themselves, usually. I'll let them have many chances at trying to kick drug habits, that's it, or alcohol problems. I'll give them chances to do public work service and stay out of jail. I now have the added pressure of knowing that I don't have a whole lot of room in jail. And if there's somebody that's going to jail, I'd rather it be somebody that is hurting people as opposed to somebody who is stealing six packs of beer. So I try to find other equally unpleasant things for them to do, like clean up the freeways and inhale the exhaust fumes of cars as they go by. But, you know, if push comes to shove and they aren't going to do what I want them to do, then I'm going to let them cool their heels in jail for a little while. And eventually there comes a point when how much more do I want out of this case? How much more does this, the state of California want? How much more is it worth spending money? And maybe I'll just say, okay, enough is enough. I'm terminating probation. You're done. See you on the next crime. And, you know, and then maybe they'll go to prison. Who knows? Because the priors will count. So in the evidence arena, when I was doing trials and when I did them as DA, as well as being a judge for a little while doing trials, the attorneys pretty well describe the evidence that they're trying to present to me. If it's a photograph, they can describe it to me. If it's a diagram, they can explain it to me. I work on the clock method like most of us do. Certain things are noon to 3 to 6, whatever, north, south, east, west. The relevance of it is another call. That's my call. But when it comes to things that need to be looked at, I wasn't overly concerned as long as it was admissible. Jurors are the ones that are actually evaluating it for what it really means to the case. It's just my question is, does the jury get to look at it? And so if I'm satisfied that it's relevant, I'll let them weigh it for whatever it's worth on guilt or innocence. Lawyers and I worked together very well when I was a DA. They may not agree with a lot of rulings from me or any other judge for that matter, but they rarely would show disrespect to any judge. In the first place, they could be held in contempt, and that would go on their record. And if the fine was more than $1,000, they're in serious trouble with the bar. I've never held a lawyer in contempt. I've been a DA. I know what schedules are like. I'm supposed to be in three places at once, so I'm pretty lenient at not making somebody stick to a time schedule with me as long as they call me and let me know where they are and when I can expect them. So I get along with attorneys. I get along with other judges. But it's a lonely life being a judge because I can't really associate with a lot of my friends if they're still practicing law. But most of my friends are retired, so that's not a problem. And I'm hoping to join their ranks soon. All right, I'll answer any questions, but I appreciate
okay, you having me. We have time for two questions. The first is David Hanlon.
And I'll
stay. I know we need to keep to a time schedule.
And I'll
so.
Stay if you need me.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Your Honor, not being able to see the facial expression in the eyes, are you confronted with and of course, many of these criminals and people that have problems have a tendency to lie and to be a con artist. Are you able to discern whether they're telling the truth or not in their explanation to you?
Well, I try. The district attorney is always present, and if he or she doesn't like what they see or thinks it's a bunch of hooey, they're going to say so in their own fashion in their argument. I do try to listen to the way somebody is talking to me. Usually nervous, lying people, it shows in their voice because they are nervous when they're lying. And they're not thinking fast on their feet if they're trying to make up a story as they go. But keeping in mind, the people that are in front of me talking to me usually are already convicted. So I know they did the crime And now I want to know why they're not doing the things to stay out of jail. And I usually am thinking most of them are giving me a story. It's amazing how many people, A, suddenly get religion. How many people have family members who are on their deathbed. How they're needed at home to take care of sick grandma because nobody else is there to take care of her, even though they're out past curfew with their gangbangers. You know, so it's pretty easy to tell, for me anyway, when somebody is feeding me a line just because they want to get out of jail.
Okay, before we take our last question from Mary Lou Barocco, is Mark Turner in the room? Our next speaker, if you could make your way up to the front while we take this last question. Okay, Mary Lou.
Yeah, thank you. Your Honor, I was wondering, was there ever an unfortunate time when you may have lawyers saying, look, I don't want this gentleman, you know, trying cases, and, you know, how did you handle this, or how do you deal with that when you have lawyers, or?
You mean a specific lawyer that I didn't think should be in front of me?
Yeah, and they said, look, I don't want him, you know, I feel his blindness, you know, as a, you know, and they say this outright, you know, how do you handle him?
Okay, you mean somebody who have a prejudice against me?
Yeah.
No, I've never had that. No.
That's good.
No. But, you know, in fairness, though, you got to remember, I've done this now for, 25, 26 years. I know the law. I've always felt a fair prosecutor. I've dealt fairly with the defense bar. When I applied to be a judge, you go through the judicial nominating process, and the defense bar gets to weigh in on you. And they get a form, and they get to ding you before you're ever even thought of being selected by the governor. And if there are things they don't like about you, it's anonymous. There's no holds barred. And they will tell you what they don't like. And you have to sit in front of two lawyers in a final interview, and they don't tell you about all the good things. They say there's these four or five things that the legal community here thinks about you. What do you say to that? And so I answered whatever the problems they felt I had, apparently satisfactorily, because I did get appointed. But, you know, there's politics involved. So, no, it hasn't been a problem. I have a great relationship with both the defense bar and the DAs.
And if everyone can please turn off those cell phones, I would appreciate it
greatly.
Yeah,
I confiscate those in court. I try to evaluate which ones are the better phones to have.
Yeah. You know, I'd like to do that. I'd like to do that in here. Well, you know, we'd have a volunteer kind of scheduled to, you know, where does it come from? And, you know, they could pick them up, and then we could really do some great door prizes.
I will say that I use a cell phone, but I use it solely as a phone. I do text once in a while, but I don't want the internet access on a phone, and I don't really need it because I'm at my chambers or I'm at home, and I'm always at my computer, so I don't really need that.
Well, everyone, please join me in thanking Judge Sapkowski for coming today.
Thank you.
All right,
thank you very much.
Yeah, I didn't put your name.
Donna Pomeranz.
Hi. All right.
President of the council. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
All right.
I'll stay in the back a few minutes.
Judge Sumowski says that he will be in the back if anyone wishes to speak with him. So thank you so much. Our next speaker, the topic is the CSU Accessible Technology Initiative. Reflecting on 6 years of progress. Okay, let's see, what did Joe say? Scrolling. I think that's what he said. Okay. All right, here we go. Reflecting on 6 years of progress, lessons learned, and current challenges. Mark Turner, Director, Center for Accessible Media, California State University, Academic Technologies Services, Long Beach, California. Please join me in welcoming Mark Turner.
Good afternoon. Can
And yes. If we can please have folks venture outside the door if you needed to do that. Or let's see, as they say it, outside, right? Is that the command? Outside. Thank you. Okay, Mark, thank you.
Okay, can folks hear me okay? Gosh, I have to get rather frighteningly close to this microphone. So well, thank you. It's a pleasure to come down and speak with you. My first CCB attendance, so I'm very excited. So I have worked in disability services in higher ed for about 20 years. I was realizing as I was prepping to drive down here from Orange County today, it's rather frightening to think about. It's essentially been my entire career. It's all I've done. It's all I've ever really wanted to do. So when the opportunity arose about 6 years ago to come to the chancellor's office, after about 14 years working on campuses, to work on a system-wide initiative, I just simply couldn't pass it up. What I've come hoping to spend some time talking about with you is kind of briefly how technology is transforming the way that we're delivering our university programs and services, how the CSU in particular is tackling technology accessibility barriers, so talk about some of the accomplishments that that we've achieved thus far, and then some of the lessons along the way. I certainly am not here to plug the CSU per se, but I think it's probably useful to just throw a couple stats out just to kind of give you a sense of the scale of what's entailed in trying to get 23 geographically distinct and culturally distinct campuses all moving in the same direction. So we have about 427,000 students and about 44,000 staff and faculty. And of that 427,000 students, we have about 11,500 registered with our disability offices. So you can think of it this way. We essentially have a mid-sized campus equivalent just of folks with disabilities enrolled in our school. So it's a pretty remarkable statistic. I have to imagine you're wondering how many of those are folks that we serve in the category of visual disabilities. So I actually looked that up, and it's about 350. And this is registered numbers, and I'm confident that we have many others that that don't register as well. So the CSU has really had a very long-standing commitment to disabilities. It goes back to 1980 when we established a system-wide policy specifically for provisions of services to students with disabilities and set up a system-wide advisory committee that has met twice a year every year for that many years. And the reason I mention our size is because it's a theme that I'll try to weave through the comments today, because I believe that our size, while logistically sometimes a challenge, also affords us the opportunity and one might say the responsibility to provide leadership in accessibility of higher education. So I don't think anyone here would disagree with the notion that technology is now a ubiquitous component of our lives. It's increasingly hard to remember a time before smartphones, mobile web, social media, iPods, iPads. Just as a little bit of a social experiment here, by a show of hands, who's currently carrying or has with them today an iPhone or an iPad? Wow. So at least I'd say, let's say half, roughly. This is extraordinary. This is extraordinary, thinking about where we've come in the 20 years that I've been in disability services. The concept that one of the best-selling electronic devices of all time can now be purchased, configured, and used by folks irrespective of their sight status is extraordinary. And it really heartens me to see that we've made progress. There's also a side of me that can be very impatient at times with the pace of that progress, but we'll speak to that a touch later. I don't imagine it would come as much of a surprise that the next thing I would point out is that technology is really transforming the way that higher ed institutions deliver our programs and services. In fact, I'd be hard-pressed to come up with any critical academic or administrative service that we provide at our universities that isn't mediated in some way by technology. And while making our curriculum and our services more electronic brings with it opportunities, it also brings with it some unique challenges as well from an accessibility standpoint that I'll get into. Actually, I missed an opportunity to tell a quick story. So I was at the National Federation of the Blind last December to give a brief presentation and participate in an event with publishers. And one of the leaders at NFB said something to me. It really struck me at the time, and it really resonates with our social experiment a moment ago. He said, "Now when I meet someone who's blind and they don't have an iPhone, my first question to them is, why?" So pretty extraordinary. So technology as a means to deliver our services. You know, we've got learning management systems, lecture capture systems, audience response systems, or what we call the clickers, right? We use those. Laboratory software, YouTube, e-textbooks. Each one of these, by virtue of being electronic, brings the possibility for removing accessibility barriers, and it also brings the possibility to introduce accessibility barriers. I think we've probably all experienced both of that. And yet, unfortunately, for all the genuine recognition I think we need to give to companies that are leading in this area, it can be a source of frustration that much of the educational technology that higher ed institutions are using wasn't really designed with accessibility in mind, and as a partial result of that, doesn't really provide adequate support for accessibility out of the box. We continue to find, as we adopt technology products, that there's limited awareness of accessibility standards, that there's little or no documentation regarding the accessibility of their support, documentation for the end user or documentation for the institution, trying to gauge whether the product is accessible. The level of commitment to accessibility is really all over the map as well. The number of times I've had to have the conversation about how they will quote unquote monetize their investment in accessibility, I shudder to think about. And so, you know, not surprisingly then, product accessibility support is not where it should be broadly in terms of educational technology. And we worry a great deal about this. And as a result, it's not, again, surprising. Accommodations related to accessible technology are a growing strain for students, but they're also a growing strain for institutions as well. The days when disability services offices focused on curb cuts, parking spots, and accessible paths of travel are really fading in memory. Today's most significant accessibility barriers on campus are usually technology related. Whether it's a cloud-based application or e-textbooks or a kiosk in the library, electronic signage, these are the 21st century curb cuts that we grapple with. And it makes it difficult for students in terms of delay and concerns about whether they'll get a comparable experience, and it makes it difficult for the institution, who has now inherited the accessibility challenges of a product that wasn't, you know, wasn't delivered with accessibility in mind. So what was really needed, it was very clear, was a shift. We needed to shift from an assistive technology model where we were focused on providing responsive accommodations to an accessible technology model where what we focused on was more universal design and trying to ensure that the technologies that we adopted were going to be usable by everyone. So in 2004, the CSU did something that up until that point, no really large university system, and we are, by some measures, the single largest public four-year university system in the country. But up until that point, no major system had tried to tackle this at a system-wide level. I'm reminded of a joke someone told me when I started at the chancellor's office. They said, do you know the quickest way to change the direction of an aircraft carrier? Anyone know the answer, by the way? Shout it out. Quickest way to change the direction of an aircraft carrier? Sink it. Suffice it to say that I didn't come to the chancellor's office to sink it, but I think there was a lesson in there somewhere in terms of trying to understand the complexities of, again, getting 23 campuses on the same page and driving in the same direction. Our goal at the ATI, I'm just going to call it the ATI, the Accessible Technology Initiative from now on, our goal was to ensure that our programs and services and activities would be accessible to all students, staff, faculty, and members of the public with whom we engage. Fairly simple, rather broad-reaching, certainly ambitious. And we started with a couple of basic principles. One was accessibility. If we were going to move from assistive technology to accessible technology, accessibility needed to be a shared responsibility of the entire campus. It could not be the case that disability services was the sole venue for being responsive to accessible technology issues. This needed to be owned by the entire institution. The second was that the technologies that we adopted, whether we bought them, whether we built them, whether we downloaded them because they were open source on the web, that these technologies needed to allow everyone, irrespective of disability status, to fully participate in and benefit from the programs and services that use those technologies. And third was that these technologies needed to provide comparable functionality, comparable timeliness, comparable affordability, or what NFB likes to call same features, same time, same cost. And that this should be done in as seamless a manner as possible. Okay, as a principle, separate is not equal. Okay, we want integration. We want technology to be the equalizer, not the remover of the barrier, not the creator of it. So our approach was to begin work to incorporate accessibility into our policies and into our business practices across the enterprise. And we identified a number of key strategies that were going to be critical. And it's those strategies and some of the results of those strategies that I really wanted to spend most of the rest of our time on. It was clear that there was no one magic bullet. There was no one tool that we were going to use to make the CSU's technology infrastructure accessible. We were going to need to use an array of tools to solve a variety of problems. The first was that we needed to put our voice and our resources where our mouth was, and that meant establishing a strong institutional commitment. Okay, the ATI can't be successful if it's just operating at a grassroots level. We have no more passionate set of advocates for access than our disability office's staff, but they can't by themselves change their institutions. That requires the involvement and buy-in of leaders from the campus president through the CIOs, the VP of Student Affairs, the Directors of Academic Technology. These folks needed to be on board, and they needed to understand that we were serious. So we established an executive order. We established a series of coded memoranda that stipulated how the executive order should be implemented. We established communities of practice in three areas we deemed critical, from accessible web, instructional materials, and procurement, so that we would have the involvement of implementers at every campus. And we involved all of the key stakeholders, the librarians, the disability offices staff, the instructional designers, the directors of academic technology, all of them, to ensure that this was going to get done in a way that reflected our commitment to shared ownership of accessibility. The second strategy that we deemed critical was we needed to establish clear goals and success indicators. I think some of you are probably familiar with the expression, failure to plan means planning to fail, right? So the ATI established a little over 40 specific goals across those three priority areas, web, instructional materials, and procurement, and about 120 success indicators. So we established what some of the key milestones should be for campuses as they moved forward with implementing the ATI. So that while the methods each campus might use might vary somewhat due to their size, their structure, their regional location, their political, sort of setup, we were all steering our ships toward the same ports of call. The third critical strategy was that in an environment where we have literally millions of web pages and tens of thousands of electronic resources, some going back 100 years, because many campuses before even the CSU existed were campuses, you know, that had media libraries and book collections, and thousands of software products used in every field of study. We needed to prioritize. Okay? There needed to be a thoughtful, considered approach to how we picked what we were going to tackle and in what order, and who we needed to enlist to be successful. While every technology barrier matters, because we don't want any technology to leave anyone behind, it was clear some mattered a great deal more. And so we established what we call the ATI prioritization framework. And this was intended to help campuses identify areas of greatest impact it asks a series of questions. Trying to my best to kind of simplify what otherwise can come across as a bit of bureaucratica, but bear with me. The number of factors we ask campuses to consider, including how widely deployed the technology is, whether it's used to deliver critical academic or administrative functions, like registration, course management systems, emergency management, whether it's the sole means by which that service is delivered or that information is conveyed, whether there are equally effective workarounds available in the interim, whether it's going to be reused repeatedly over time, whether the kind of information that's conveyed is of special relevance to folks with disabilities. And this allowed campuses sort of a conceptual framework for making effective decisions about how they were going to tackle technology accessibility barriers. The fourth strategy was that we needed to support campus implementations. We didn't want this to be a pronouncement from on high, not backed by support and resources. If this was going to be successful, again, we needed to step up and put our money where our mouth was. Broadening accessibility from the job of the disability office to the job of every staff and faculty on a campus necessitates a great deal of raising awareness and providing business processes and tools that allow people to do their job differently than perhaps they've done in the past. So this meant setting up and operating many training conferences, periodic webinars, producing training modules that campuses could deploy, they could adopt or adapt, establishing a professional development website where we collected the exemplary practices and the promising tools, so that we didn't have 23 campuses trying to discover solutions to the same problem 23 times. Conducting monthly meetings with the communities of practice, meeting with the executive sponsors, to identify where we were making progress and trying to do postmortem on why things were working well, but also not, you know, being fearless enough to do postmortems and look at why we weren't making progress in other areas. Which takes us to the fifth strategy, which was, it was, in our view, it was critical that we measure, document our progress over time. Having long-term broad goals is helpful because, again, it provides a way to, it serves as a reminder of why you're working on what you're working on. But we felt it was critical that campuses be prepared to document the specific steps they were taking, the specific areas that, in which they were making progress, the specific areas where they were struggling. And so that's each year what they do. We have an annual cycle where they review and revise their annual plans. They select and implement projects and activities that reduce accessibility barriers. They then document their progress in their activities each year in reports that go to the chancellor's office. We then aggregate that information, review it, analyze it, and put out a sort of a state of the state report so that each campus is able to see where they are, where they've benchmarked relative to the system as a whole. And this also allows us at the chancellor's office to identify when there are areas where multiple campuses are struggling, because it suggests that perhaps we need to look at providing more support in that area. But it also means we know where campuses are doing well, and how we can help campuses package information about why they were successful in an area and share that with campuses that are struggling. The sixth strategy that we used was, we realized that we could not solve this, no matter how large an institution we were. We could not solve the systematic absence of robust accessibility support among IT products alone, that we needed to work closely with and constructively with the IT industry so that they could make meaningful changes to the way they conceptualize, design, build, test, and deploy technology. Okay. The customer has great importance in the marketplace, but at the end of the day, it's the vendor's products that we expect to be accessible. So that means there's two things that we do with vendors, and this is where I think we learned the most. The first was, and these are the classic carrot and stick. Okay, so I'll start with the carrot. So there are many reasons we realized why vendors were not always producing accessible products. Why accessibility support was not robust when we would test the products, and we concluded our preferred method was to meet and try and establish constructive partnerships with them. Our experience was, it was rarely the case that vendors considered accessibility and simply concluded it was too much trouble or was not relevant to what they were doing. That was exceedingly rare. What we generally found was, the developers and the product managers who were building these products simply never thought about it. It wasn't part of their training. It wasn't part of the policies of the company. And it wasn't part of the key design requirements. How are we doing on time? Oh, my goodness. Okay. All right, then I'm going to have to speed through this. So I'm going to talk about a couple of examples of victories here. One is, we did work with a company we're finishing up right now, a company called Alex, where they had built a web-based math tutorial system. And it was done probably 15 years ago using Java. And it wasn't compatible with assistive technology. and it presented major accessibility barriers. So they contracted with us. We did an evaluation, prepared reporting, and were able to significantly influence the prototype that they were building to replace their aging architecture using accessible HTML and JavaScript. And this is a product that's used by hundreds, if not thousands, of institutions around the world. We also realized it was important to be part of accessibility interest groups for vendors to influence decisions they made about how they prioritize accessibility at, relative to other ways in which they improve products. And then lastly, we realized we needed to leverage the power of our procurement process to drive vendor improvements. And this was the stick. So in 2008, we did a system-wide learning management system request for proposal. And Blackboard at that time was used by more than half of our campuses. Yet when we did our testing, and this won't come as a surprise to any of you who've been in college recently, Blackboard had really serious accessibility problems. And we did something that up until that point, no large university system had done. They did not prevail in the contract. We did not select them as part of the system-wide contract. And that was an action that the Blackboard CEO later called the wake-up call that they needed to reactivate their accessibility effort. And we did a similar thing with iTunes University. At the time that we evaluated iTunes University, it had absolutely no support for accessibility. And the media was not available with captions. And the storefront wasn't usable without sighted assistance.
Can the person who has their iPhone on please put your headphone back on so the rest of us don't hear you going through your messages?
So,
thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So in my last minute or so, let me just say we gave Apple 10 months to address their iTunes U accessibility issues. 12 months. And they finished in 10. By the time that year was done, they had ensured that their application worked with the accessibility APIs used by AT. They'd rewritten their storefront, and they'd added support for captioned media. But it took a large institutional customer to say, this is not okay, and we won't use your product until we've done that. Until you've done that. And then lastly, we realized we needed to get connected with others. We work closely with legislative analysts, our colleagues at other institutions, with disability advocacy groups like the NFB, and with the vendor community, because we realize that we all win when products are universally designed. The student avoids accommodations, the vendor has a larger audience for their products, and the institutions that adopt those products don't have to focus on accommodations and can instead focus on providing exemplary services. I had a brief minute or two to cover lessons learned, but I think in the interest of time, perhaps I'll need to save that for another day. So thank you.
Thank you very, very much. It's definitely be, and that iPhone's still going. Wow. I wish Judge Dumowski was still here. Then we could have a really nice door prize. Let me see if we can take one question. Okay. I heard Mitch, and then I will do Vita. Gene, I'm sorry. You can catch him.
Sir, I'm Mitch Pomerantz, president of the American Council of the Blind, and you've twice mentioned our friends across the aisle at NFB, but you need to know that regardless of what the NFB tells you, I have members in my organization who are still using Blackboard and still find it inaccessible. I'll be happy. Unfortunately, the person that specifically comes to mind is not in California, but the NFB would have us believe that Blackboard is fully accessible. We know otherwise. Thank you.
That's valuable information, and I'd be happy to hang out in the back afterward. I'd love to get a little bit more information and be able to follow up with you about that, because I would certainly be the first to say that... I know Blackboard not to be fully accessible, but I also know that they have made meaningful progress and that a lot of what used to require.
Yes.
Indeed, they do.
Vida.
Good afternoon, Mark. My question is, do you have some idea of how many people with disabilities are actually employed in accessibility services in the campuses, CSU campuses?
Wow, that's a great question. You know, I've worked in the system now for about 16 years. I would love to be able to say I could come up with a number because I know most of I know most of those folks. I could only hazard a guess, and I'm not sure it would really be fair given that I haven't, you know, I've only been on site with about three quarters of the campuses, but it's numerous.
Okay. Thank you very much. And if you could connect with Gene Lozano, who's our vice president, after your presentation, because I know he had a question for you. So if you could touch base with him, that would be great. Everybody, please join me in thanking Mark Turner. Thank you very much. Okay. The Joshua Project. We have Christy Goldenberg, treasurer and secretary of the Joshua Project Foundation from Santa Barbara, California.
Simi Valley. It says Santa Barbara.
It says Santa Barbara. Yeah. Okay. What we got was was sent to us. So
yeah, that's okay.
So I join me, everyone, in welcoming them to our conference and convention for their presentation.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here. And we want to say thank you for everyone being so welcoming. It's our very first conference. I'm sitting up here with Joshua himself and my husband, Evan. We'll each take a little turn speaking about the Joshua Project. I will start off. I'm going to quickly tell you the story behind the Joshua Project. One day while shopping, I'm a sighted mother of two. One day while shopping with my blind son Joshua at the grocery store, we were looking for batteries for one of his toys, and I told him that they were out. He said to me, "Well, let me feel." So I let him feel where the batteries were supposed to be, but he said, no, where's the Braille? And I said, "Well, there is no Braille." And he said, "Well, how am I supposed to shop if there's no Braille?" Great question. Yee. Of all the things I've thought of as a parent, that wasn't one of the things I had looked up. So I went home and started to look it up, and Josh kept insisting there needs to be Braille in there so that I can shop. Okay, this is the story behind the Joshua Project. I'm going to back up a little bit now and tell you who I am. As I mentioned, I am a sighted 44-year-old woman married 17 years to my husband, Evan. We have two children. Hannah, who is 15 and a half, and Joshua, who is 8. I've been lucky enough to be a stay-at-home mom up until about a year ago. Thank you. About a year ago, I decided to go back to work. I now work for our school district as a special education aide, and I work out of our house as a book reviewer. I had toxemia during my first pregnancy with my daughter, which caused her to be born 3 months early. My doctor told me not to get pregnant again. 8 years later, I was. it was an accident. But 15 weeks into pregnancy, during an ultrasound, they found the baby was missing his right eye and gave me the option to abort. I said, why would I do that? We had more ultrasounds, which revealed no other complications or issues. Continued with the pregnancy, gave birth to Joshua. At 3 months old, Joshua was taken to UCLA for a regular eye test on the eye that he did have. And they told us that he had a condition called bilateral microphthalmia. His optic nerves had never developed. At 18 months old, my son, who was always very energetic, began slamming his head against walls and our hardwood floor. I didn't understand this and thought he was just strange until someone told me that that was something I should probably have looked at. We took him to Children's Hospital where he had glaucoma and had to have that eye enucleated. By the time Joshua was 5 years old, he had endured 4 surgeries on his eye sockets and now wears 2 beautiful blue prosthetic eyes. We began having services right away. By the time that Josh was 3 years old, he started preschool at a regular preschool. And we were working with somebody from a place who had a lot of years and knowledge working with blind children. She had a lot of very interesting opinions in as we were raising Josh, like, blind people don't like water. Don't ever put him in the water. This seemed very strange to me because my son always loved bath time. And so when we went on family vacation once, I put him in the swimming pool. My son today swims very well. After a while, I got tired of all the negativity too, telling me all the things he wouldn't be able to do and all the things the school district would never provide. And at that point, my husband and I decided to take a new path. We started hiring aides who had never worked with the blind, who had positive attitudes and good hearts, somebody who would see him as an individual, somebody who would see him as Joshua, my blind son, and not my blind son, Joshua. We're not a typical family. We have a very unique way of doing things. We choose to have a lot of humor. I horrify and amuse people with stories about Joshua losing his eye at the mall one day and showing it to the woman at the store when she said, "What was that?" and she almost passed out. Joshua has a great sense of humor himself, loving to get in my face. And when I say, "What are you doing?" he says, "I'm staring at you." Joshua today loves to ride a bike. He loves to swim, hike. He is proficient at climbing 150-foot rock walls. He plays classical piano for over 2 years now. He's very independent with a great sense of humor and a beautiful and loving heart, especially towards his sister. My daughter, Hannah, is a writer and an artist. And anytime she does a picture, Josh will be the first one to run over and say, "Oh, Hannah, that's beautiful." We have high expectations for Josh, just like Hannah. College, job, living independently. And one day somebody came up to me and said, "You're so lucky your son's blind. He'll never leave home." I said, "Oh my, if that boy turns 20 and he's still in my house, I have failed badly as a parent." Josh started attending preschool, as I mentioned, at 3. He now attends our public elementary school. He's in the second grade. He began learning with a cane at age 3 because he insisted on it. He began learning Braille around the same time. He's now in second grade, and he's a straight-A student. He's using a Perkins Brailler and a Mountbatten Brailler. He has JAWS and is learning on typability. He's a math guy with an amazing memory, having so far memorized the first 250 numbers of pi. He was recently given a Braille note by someone we met to start learning that, since the school district deemed it too early. Somebody gave us one to let him borrow, and we'll go ahead with that. Things I've learned in having a blind son is that in some ways, I think he's so lucky not to have sight, and because I think so much of our world is about this person being this color skin or this tall or this thin or these kind of clothes or this kind of hair. And I so admire when he meets somebody, he judges everybody by how he feels. I think how nice the world would be if everybody else could do that. My children are here to teach me and not the other way around. That is my personal belief. I know nothing. They seem to know a lot more than I do. And that have that attitude, like I know it all and I'll teach it to them. I find it better to flip that around and learn from them and be open to new ideas and new perspectives. I've also learned that positive people with good hearts and intentions are sometimes better to work with than those that have a lot of knowledge or experience in the field of the blind. The Joshua Project is having many unseen benefits, like empowering children and letting them know that they can make a difference in the world. It teaches tolerance. It opens up a conversation with parents, because in my experience, it's usually the parents that are the problem, not the children. I'm going to pass it over to Joshua now so he can fill you in a little bit more about his project. Oops. Okay, there you go. Go ahead.
Don't say a word.
Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Zoss. I'm 8 years old. My mom called me Joshua, but I do like to be called Zoss, so please call me Zoss.
Good for you.
Is there anybody in this room that's not blind? Raise your hand. Oh wait, don't raise your hand. I can't see.
You're too much.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you what I like to do first, and then I'll tell you about the project. I like to jump on trampolines with somebody. My dad can jump super high. He can make me fly up in the air like, yeah. Okay, I'm going to tell you the story about the Joshua Project. Mommy, the microphone's not like,
yeah, it's fine. Go ahead.
One day, I was shopping with my mom for batteries for one of my toys, and she said, there's none. And I said, yeah, let me feel. So I felt. And my mom said, see, there's none. And I said, I can't see. And there's no braille, so I can't stop. And my mom said, how can I stop if there's no braille? And my mom was like, good question. So she went home. And she went home, she looked it up, and then my dad got home, and my mom and my dad started discussing it, like, how can we do this? And then finally my mom and dad agreed, and I brailled some of the stores. First I brailled Trader Joe's, but they took it down. That was sad. But now Whole Foods in Thousand Oaks, like close to my house, is sticking with it now. So they still have it up. I put it up like about a year ago. So yeah. And then I brailled Whole Foods, and then I brailled Boston, that Whole Foods, and then I brailled Santa Barbara Whole Foods. Now Gelson's and the Whole Foods in and Albertsons contacted us.
What?
To put Braille up. And one more store, I forgot what it was called. Let me ask my dad. Whole Foods in Tarzana and Vons are both. So I have a lot of stores. No, Mommy. Okay. So yeah, I did that, and I want to braille every other grocery store in the world, and it's important because when I grow up, I want to go shopping by myself, and I want other blind people to go shopping by themselves, too.
Good job. Here's my daughter.
No, I'm not done yet.
Yes, that's it. That's good. We're going to talk to people afterwards.
All right, here's my dad, Evan. Thank you very much for letting me talk to you guys, and here's my dad.
I don't know how I'm going to, I'm going to follow that, but, so that's my son. He's very shy. I just want to reiterate what he said about the Joshua Project really did start from a simple question, and that was, how am I supposed to go shopping if there's no Braille? This led us to a whole bunch of questions. Not ever dealt with the blind community before. We did our own research. We did Google. We contacted. We found out that the Braille Institute and the NFB and the California Council of the Blind and everybody else don't exactly speak with each other all the time. So the answers we received are varied. We actually saw videos and we heard stories of people who go shopping and they wait 10 to 15 minutes for somebody to help escort them around a store, which really isn't a horrible thing. I mean, it's nice to be able to meet people and find the generosity of others, which actually has helped us to where we are today. However, when I see people like my son who are so fiercely independent, he would never wait for somebody to help him. He would be swinging his cane. He wouldn't be like that. So when we walk into a store, we know how, as sighted people, we go shopping. We know that we can walk over and see that there's red peppers and green peppers and yellow peppers. We know that when we go down an aisle to see what's in the aisle, we look up because that's what says it's in the aisle. And what's happening is we're getting to a point where we're realizing that it's not a simple process. It all came up with the question is, can't we make this a little bit easier? And the process that we put into place is not perfect. It's kind of the first step of what we wanted to do. And we Braille at the produce section. We will put a Braille label with a sign on each piece of produce, not each piece of produce, but each section. Yeah, that would be fun, huh? That's a full-time job. Yeah. No, on each box. In other words, we have it separated. On every aisle of the store, there is a list of what is on that aisle. Not only is that aisle blade that stick out have a list of what's on the aisle, but it's also got very large wording, so people who can't see up above the aisle can just look at that sign that's right there too. Some of the store shelves actually have Braille on it, so you can trail your way down and see it as well. It's a long process. There is something that we just came up with recently that's at the Santa Barbara Whole Foods. We have a store directory that was put out in front of the store. And what I call it is narrowing down the store. You have a 20,000 square foot facility and you want to find milk. And the idea behind doing that is somebody would have to escort you back. However, at the front of this store, we have a tactile map. It is made of a lucite. It's got Braille all over the front of it. And it kind of gives you an idea of what the shape of the store is, where the aisles are, where the dairy products are. And it'll bring you to wherever you need to go. And then amongst each aisle, it starts narrowing it down so you can get down to within a couple of feet. The next one is going to be the adaptive technology. There's a lot of technology that's coming out that's going to go along with the Braille. When Josh came up with the idea and we Brailled the Thousand Oaks store, we won an award from the National Braille Press, who flew us back to Boston to accept their yearly hands-on award. And while we were out there, Whole Foods said, please, we're right by the Perkins School for the Blind and the Carroll Institute. There is a Whole Foods out here. So we opened up that store. There was a showing of probably about 40 people. The Boston Globe got involved. By the time we flew back, we had Santa Barbara asking for it. We now have Tarzana. The Joshua Project has won the Mayor's Award, presented by Mayor Schneider in Santa Barbara, who had given us the award. And although we live in Simi Valley an hour away, I'm going there every week to join up with a lot of the other stores that are interested. Albertsons, like Josh said, has contacted us. They want to start doing at least two stores. Gelson's, which is a smaller Southern California store that's got 17 stores, they just called me. They want to do it in their stores, and we're at a point where it's starting to grow by leaps and bounds. We're not really sure why it hasn't been up. This question hadn't been answered before, but I had said that it took the vision of my 7-year-old little boy to make this a reality.
But you were 7.
The idea behind the Joshua Project goes even a little bit further. And, you know, when Josh was born, like my wife, we figured that if we raise him the same, he'll grow up the same. If we raise him differently, he'll be different. And we didn't want him to be different. We wanted him to fit in with everybody else. And he's learning that the world isn't just going to conform to him. And as we, you know, I figured I would drop him off at school one day. You know, I have a very, very smart daughter. I drop her off at 8, I pick her up at 1, she's brilliant. So I figured I would take my son, drop him off at 8, pick him up at 1, everything will be fine. But hearing that, oh, we don't have somebody who teaches Braille. We don't have somebody who, we don't have a resource center. It was the most ridiculous thing I had heard. I said, how am I supposed to have my son thrive in a community where everything is about reading and writing? I don't know one sighted person that is successful today because they don't know how to read and write. And I became very passionate about it. In any case, everything we've been doing is for our son, and it has turned into a national thing. When we were invited to speak out here, we didn't know how to approach it. We didn't know what to say. This is our first conference. This is our first time standing up and discussing what we want to do. In a perfect world for my son, there would be Braille everywhere. In addition to the technology, the Braille to me is what's important. I just heard today that there's a 70% unemployment, and I know from the statistics I read that the people who are fluent in reading and writing Braille, it's just the opposite. And I know that it coincides with learning to be independent. So as we grow, we want to bring with us that the children growing up need to know how important it is to be independent. You know, I don't want my son to grow up and have somebody help him. It wouldn't happen anyway, but I want him to know that he can get up one day, he can jump on the bus, he can go down to the store, he can go shopping and come home. He doesn't have to call me and say, I need some milk. And that's what our goal is. So as we walked around the hotel, we saw Braille on the doors, on the elevators, on the rooms. It's all over the place. And it's amazing to see people getting around the way that they do. And if we can just add Braille throughout the grocery stores the way my son wants it, it's going to bring it back to where the schools are going to have Braille for everybody, not just because somebody asked for it. So I thank Whole Foods Market and Santa Barbara and a lot of the people there for everything. And thank you guys all so much for having us.
Okay, we have time for, there's Ed. We have time for a few questions, if you'd be willing to take a couple of questions from the audience. Great.
Yeah, this is Charlene Ornelas from San Diego.
Charlene.
The Braille Club. I wanted to know, and it's great about the labeling, but are you able to put the prices on there too?
That's been asked by us quite a bit. It depends because, as we all know, Braille's the same size. And what's happening is they're cramming more and more stuff on store shelves. There is a possibility that it will be. But what's happening is with the adaptive technology, if you can find your way through a store and get to a point where you say, okay, here's the Cheerios that I want, there is a handheld scanner that you can actually scan the barcode and it'll read it to you. We believe that's going to be the easiest way. However, with the Nemeth system and my son just learning all that now, I'm sure it could be done. It's just a matter of squeezing too much into too small of a space.
Okay. Linda?
Hi, Madam President and Joshua and Joshua's parents. Good. Yeah, you know, when you're a short person, you kind of move things around to make them fit, right? Anyway, I just wanted to make a comment that there are many of us in this room who are living on our own and who awesome. Are independent people, whether we're students, whether we're working or looking for jobs or seniors. There are many of us of all age groups who have found our own place and our own lives and ways of doing things. So Joshua and your parents, I think you don't have as much to worry about as the people in the school district think you do. Thank you.
Well, Jet. And I want you to know that we are going to follow in all of your footsteps because we don't know. So when I hear that, when I see it, it's so important to us. So thank you.
We have another question, but what I would share with you is in our organization, we have people who are teachers. We have people who've worked for the state legislator's office. We have attorneys. We have all kinds of people within the organization. So I would say it's great. You can be what you want to be if you want to be it. So thank you very much. And let me take the next question. Okay, Dirk is, Ed has his roller skates on and he's getting back there with the wireless.
Josh, how do you pay for all the brailing?
Josh.
How do you pay for all the brailing?
It's a non-profit and people have been donating money to us, so I'm very happy about that.
One of Evan's customers came to us after we brailed the first store. This was not our intention to start a non-profit. But my husband sells cars, and one of his customers heard about what we were doing and approached him and said, you guys need to turn this into a nonprofit and spread it out through the United States. And kindly donated his nonprofit attorney and all the money for us to get the filing done. And for the last year, we've been scrambling to learn about a nonprofit and how they're run and put together a board and a website and everything else. All the money has been donated to keep us going so far, and it has been an amazing adventure.
And the other thing is, when we opened up everything came from us initially. Now, we don't have lots of money. I mean, it's not who we are. We're just like everybody else out here. So when we opened up the JoshuaProjectFoundation.org, it cost us money for the website, it cost us money for this, but it was that important. And what's happened is so many other people, we're finding out that philanthropy is the new greed. We're finding that out from companies all over the place that they're trying to outdo each other saying, well, I donated to this person, or look what I've donated. Yeah. So and I'm gonna ride on those coattails as long as I can, because right now it costs us we have to get, our next step is to buy an embosser, which with the software and everything is going to be another few thousand. And Josh uses his Perkins Brailler to braille all of this. Thousands and thousands of braille labels. So, and even me, I'm sighted. I can read braille by looking at it now from doing it for so long. So,
I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to end here. I realize there are a few other questions, but please join me in thanking Joshua and his parents for coming to our convention. And I hope that you do some more exploring and more people will be coming and going. And again, thank you so very much for coming. I want to make a quick announcement in the program. First Timers is set in Dana Point. We are having First Timers here in this room. So if there's anyone that you know who is going to First Timers, or if you're going to First Timers, you know where we're at. So you already have the upper hand. So First Timers is in here. Okay. We will do one quick door prize and then close the session. So, and we have a ticket to the banquet. And a bag of fudge. Let's see who we have. Allison Debner, are you in the room?
Is she here?
Allison?
Raise your hand. No hands.
No hands. Okay, next one.
Artist Bazin.
Artist Bazin. Yay! All right, artists. Now I know where to get that wonderful fudge if I don't win any. Okay, everyone, we will see you at our next session. And remember, First Timers is here. Thank you.